but here's what I'm saying about the customers of AWS, about the region, US region one. Look, you have no excuse to not be using multiple regions. If you really, first you got to figure out as a vendor, provider of services, products, whatever it is, if you can say, well, look, how resilient do I need to be? How quickly do I need to recover?
The Adversarial Podcast. Why you gotta be so adversarial? It's time to get adversarial.
Hey guys, welcome back to the Adversarial Podcast. Always fun to be jumping right back in. A lot going on. Seems like that's never, there's never a dearth of cybersecurity news. Amazon, the AWS outage was not related to cyber. I really believe that to this moment.
Or AI.
Or anything AI. Could happen. Yes, despite at least one headline.
It was an article that blamed AI.
Yeah. Well, let's get into that. But this is definitely the headline of this period. Even though it's not a cybersecurity direct thing, I think you guys are in the same boat. Our circles were pretty affected by this and consumed to talking about it, you know, quite a bit for sure. Well, let's jump right into it. So AWS outage, I'll say, and this pisses people off whenever I do it, I'll say it was kind of not a big deal. And all the headlines I saw talk about it in the quick recap and the like for the layperson, like massive outage affecting, and every single time it named like five things, and Snapchat was probably the biggest one. And sorry, I can't get that excited about that. Like I can't share my snaps until a little bit later. Like, yeah.
My kid was crying. What are you talking about?
Apoplectic? Jerry? Okay. Yeah, that's probably it. But no, I mean, there was some. So I teach at Georgia Tech, right? Canvas, the infrastructure.com, instructure.com. That company was down hard. And I asked the students during a lecture, I said, hey, are you guys really affected by this? You know, what is it? And one student spoke up and said, we don't know because we'd find out via Canvas. It's down. So it had some impact there. People joke about there was a bed company that used cloud services in order to get the remote updates. So your bed was stuck in whatever setting you had it in when this happened. I think as a species, we're resilient enough to make it through that. But we'll see. Well, what about you guys? You impacted?
I spotted this because I play mobile games, and I loaded one of the games and it said, hey, temporary, maintenance. Then I loaded a completely different one and had this same effect. I was like, wait a second, something is up, because it was Duolingo and then Clash of Clans. And I was like, all right, two systems down at the same time and under maintenance, unannounced. To your point, not that it was critical, but it was observed by lots of people. Not everyone, of course, knew what the underlying issue was at the time. But I think the one thing that I see frequently being called out is AWS as critical infrastructure. And I think, this is not being adversarial per se, but I agree with Jerry's at least perspective of not a big deal. But not in the same way that maybe you were saying. I think it impacted a lot of different organizations in ways that we will find out later, or won't be publicly disclosed. So it had a non-trivial impact for sure. Is it, should we call it critical infrastructure? I think that the part I have some difficulty on this is that the outage occurred, it took about 6 hours, I think, to resolve. And if, So for one, if you were solely dependent upon US East 1 for all your services, when I look at the shared responsibility model of sorts, it's not in the shared responsibility model here, but in some respects, when it comes to one's use of cloud services, resiliency of your operations is your issue. It's not AWS's issue. And I think we have to recognize that this is like the CrowdStrike issue. This is you should treat this as a resiliency exercise. So that bad company that you were talking about, what they did is they said, wait, why why are we dependent on cloud for such a basic function? Let's roll out a Bluetooth feature that lets you control it via Bluetooth, and that doesn't even touch the cloud, right?
Wait, did that actually happen, or are you just hypothetical?
Yeah, it did.
Oh, wow. Wow, that was fast.
Hey, but Sunil, I missed that. Was U.S. East region that was impacted, Sunil?
Totally U.S. East
that.
One, just U.S.
Yes, oh. Yes. And,
just to be clear, sorry to interrupt you for a second, Sunil. Some people started sharing that video little like diagram that shows basically that the entire internet is this house of cards and has very one little weak leg of Amazon US East One. I think the most important thing for people to realize is that that image was not made in the last week. I remember seeing that image for years already.
It's not just US East One. It's Ashburn, Virginia. Okay.
Yeah.
Not that attackers don't already know this, but you know, if you wanted to nuke 70% of the internet, you just drop a bomb somewhere in Ashburn, Virginia, and you'll wipe out 70% of the internet.
Ah, yeah, God forbid. But so I don't know, the thing. I'll take a different adversarial point of view on it, right? So, I mean, So this happened, and there's all these companies that are going to run around now and say, what are we going to do? Like, to your point, the bed company, right?
Uh-huh.
I would argue maybe that there's a point where it's shared fate. Like, if US East One is down, for most companies, even if your service is down, it's such a massive impact on the whole world that people aren't faulting you and that people will get over it. I mean, if you have a pacemaker that's dependent on it, that's a different story. But if you have a pacemaker that's dependent on, you know, the SaaS in general, you have a problem. So,
I think we have to recognize
the same boat.
And you have to recognize that again. If you have if you're singly dependent upon one part of AWS or just AWS in general for your services, and you have a critical business service, then it's your fault for not designing it with that resiliency in mind.
No, but hold on. I wouldn't say it's your fault. If that risk is acceptable, then that's okay.
It should be acceptable critical,
for a lot more companies than people are willing to admit.
I totally agree. I agree on that front altogether that if it's a business service or a service that you don't need to rely upon to deliver your business and your business, you can suffer an outage of, I don't know, 8 hours, 6 hours, without having to deal with customers being angry at you or whatever, then sure, you don't need that resiliency at all.
Yeah. And the financial companies don't have this much vulnerability or impact, right? The banks, now they've been forced. No, they forced us to have different deployments when I was a Snowflake. Mm-hmm. You banks forced us to do that.
Yeah. Operational resilience is a huge deal for financial services. So I would be surprised if any bank, or I don't know about any bank, but if banks were affected by the AWS outage, I would say as an industry, they probably were significantly less affected because of all the push towards operational resiliency.
I think the biggest headline here is that Sunil has enough time in his day to play video games, honestly. The guy travels all over the world. Maybe that's what he's doing. But he reads books. You guys all see how much he reads, this guy, right? I have no idea how he does that. I'm going to call Bull Pucky. He doesn't play video games.
Look, Duolingo. You know, yo habla español.
Were you thinking of Duolingo when you said video game? And by the way, I heard at least two other people impacted by Duolingo during the outage. That was like, yeah, I don't know. But I mean, with this thing, like if this means that AWS is going to be down for 7 hours on average every 12 years, to do proper risk management, a lot of people out there need to say, okay, that's okay.
Yeah.
And it was 3 hours, right? It was a 3 hour total. Somebody keep me
well,
honest.
Well, 6 hours. Felt to me like the knock-on effects were for a good 12 or so, but apparently the documented time is 6.
Well, no. So knock-on effects. So, okay. So I'm sure there's a clear timeline, so I don't have to, we don't have to make it up and all. But it was something like a initial issue, and within AWS itself, it lingered for like 6 hours. But the knock-on effects, I think that Jerry, you're talking about, other companies having to get things systems back up and running again. I think that's their company. That's a company. That's their issue, right? And I think we're seeing the same sort of issue when it comes to the conversation that we had about Jaguar several weeks ago. and the Jaguar still is still, I think, not able to get their production.
It's over 30 days now, again. Right? 30 days? Over 30
longer
days?
Longer than that, I think. Yeah. But anyway, the point is that, you know, ransom, okay, so great. The ransomware or some issue occurred. At beyond the, let's get the systems reimaged, everything else is JLR's fault for not having cold start, you know, sort of procedures or black start sort of procedures. I think every organization should, at least for their critical business services, understand how to do black start.
It's not at all trivial. Like all of this stuff
is
not trivial, including, by the way, regional diversity within AWS. I mean, a lot of the companies that had an interruption, I'm sure, thought they had diversity, if not against the provider, against the region. I suspect a lot of them wasted money on what they thought was. Because if there's just one little component in your stack that doesn't have diversity, then you don't have diversity.
I don't have a lot. Look, here's the smallest violin right now, okay? Tears for some of these customers. First of all, kudos to AWS. They don't have these things that often. Let's praise him. There was probably some error, human errors. I don't know the gist of it, but they were able to quickly recover.
Don't say it,
yes, you're dependent
on
AWS. What is it?
Sunil is going to want to use a three-letter acronym for a popular technology that gets blamed for a lot of things.
But that's not the problem.
The problem was a race condition. But
here's what I'm saying about the customers of AWS, about the region, US region one. Look, you have no excuse to not be using multiple regions. If you really, first you got to figure out as a vendor, provider of services, products, whatever it is, if you can say, well, look, how resilient do I need to be? How quickly do I need to recover? So if your analysis is saying you need to recover within 3-4 hours, but you only in US East one, come on, folks.
Totally
agree. Modern days. Okay. So
but
don't
someone
come back.
In that meeting needs to be willing to go 3 hours, we could probably go 6. No one wants
Correct.
To do that in organizations where culturally everybody's just trying to be on the record as saying that, you know, they support the troops, right? Somebody has to be in there to be like, look, we can go longer. I've done the math. It would suck. We don't want to do it. Because a lot of the companies that had an issue, they just spent fake money on optics to say they had more resiliency. And no one's getting fired for the fake board updates for the last 3 quarters that said they had resiliency. It's just kind of a game.
I don't want to say laziness. But in
no,
this,
look, this
given
is everybody.
Time, you have
this is normal companies.
But everybody, but you should be able to have, like, easily, technically, feasibly be able to have some recovery from one. That just even.
Well, let's wind back the clock, okay? There's a metaphor here between cloud region resiliency and backups, right? So if we go back, the same thing. Everybody had backups, right? And then when you deleted files, 90% of the time you couldn't restore them. Always a great reason. Oh, well, that tape was on the blah, 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 and whatever. Never could restore, right? You never had backups until you created a job that would randomly select a file once every quarter and tell people. And when you did that, it failed the first 3 quarters. And then you got your crap together when you realized, right?
Yeah.
And to Sunil's point, he called it a black start. And we had this issue, right? We had in data centers, power resiliency is massive, right? You can imagine, you know, you always have multiple grids and then multiple routes within the data center. All this, you want to make sure you have AB lines in every single rack and so on, multiple power supplies, all this stuff you engineer for, right? If somebody starts getting electrocuted anywhere up to and including in a data center, you don't want the AB to fail over. You don't want the generator to kick in to make sure he keeps getting electrocuted. You don't want the battery backup to make sure there's no gap in the electrocution. Right. So there's a button called the emergency power off, the EPO, that damn well better power off all of the power because you're saving someone's life. So all that stuff that is talked about goes out the window really fast when you hit it. And we had a data center outage where we had a video of it. It was just unbelievable, priceless. You see some guy who works at the data center walking by the cage and he goes to go out and something about like the door. He didn't know which way to go and he turns. That's what it was. He hits the breaker bar to open the door for an emergency exit and doesn't realize it's an emergency. So the alarm goes off. And then he's looking around kind of panicked and he sees the EPO button and he opens up the break glass type thing and he hits the button to make the alarm go off, de-energizes a massive data center. We had other data centers. We had regional diversity. We had, you know, the Fed and CFTC and everybody else walk through and put their stamp on all that kind of stuff. We got the power back up. I could tell you firsthand, there was unbelievable heroics and great subject matter expertise and institutional knowledge to let us get everything really back up in about 8 hours when we had power back again. Because until you, just turning things on, like a black start, totally, is not trivial, right? Synchronization, what's up before what, all this corruption on disk. It was unbelievable to get it up. So after that, we started doing data center de-energization testing. Yeah. And it's just like the backup restoration. Mm-hmm. So if anyone does care enough about regional diversity or, God forbid, cloud provider diversity, if you think you're going to go from AWS to Google, you better do it next week and you better schedule it. We literally would run businesses, clearinghouses 1 week per quarter out of a different state. Mm-hmm. And everybody's like, oh, yeah, that sounds cool. What, you really want to do it? Massive effort. And I just don't think most companies can afford that. So most of this is optics.
But you don't have to go to that level, though, Jerry. But Jerry, you don't have to be that resilient, right? You just have to. Even having a warm spot, just have servers at another location, another region to move your traffic to.
I wouldn't even go. I mean, for cost reasons, I wouldn't even go warm. I would just say, just demonstrate the ability to spin up. Like if you have, if you move towards, you know, infrastructure as code, if you can design towards that sort of mindset. Which is kind of what cloud is designed for, right? Can you spin? So if you want to spin up instead of US East 1, US East 2, okay? Or, you know, Central or whatever, just change your scripts to basically point to that. Of course, you need to have all the services there. It's not trivial to do so, but nonetheless, I think the point is you don't need to necessarily have anything warm. You just have to be able to demonstrate that you can spin up resources somewhere else.
So you're saying you don't need 50 millisecond failover, but you want to go from 2 weeks down to 8 hours by making sure you're ready. And but like if I'm on the board of Duolingo, and you know this is probably going to ruin my chances of getting on the board of Duolingo, and I'm sure it's not a public company or whatever. But when people say we don't want it to ever happen again, we need to make sure we don't. I'm going to say this is what that will require. We're in AWS. If you're going to waste a penny at this company on GCP and on SREs working on all that, then I want us to run out of there once a quarter. Oh, it's not worth that. Yeah. Then screw it. Wind it all back. Let's save some money. Go full hog on AWS, which is probably what I'd recommend. Uh-huh. And not waste any time pretending that we're going to fail over it. Because if we're not going to test it, it's never going to work in reality.
Yeah. Let me make a connection. I think I'm going to steal Sunil's thunder because he had briefly mentioned it, the Land Rover situation. I think it's 30 plus days. I don't know if they're up now.
I think they're making some spray painting some cars now.
Okay. So let me make the connection between AWS recovering in 12 hours. I'm not talking about their clients, but let's just say AWS itself, 6 to 12
hours,
Right? Then Land Rover, we have 30 plus days. And let me make it a connection to the lube heist that just happened this week.
Okay.
And I'm making a connection. This is not my original thought. Our buddy Yasir, former CISO of Okta and Splunk, put on his LinkedIn what we can learn from the loop heist. And listen to this. He had eight
points. Now the CISO of Calendly. I want to give them a plug. It's an Atlanta company.
He, great guy, by the way. Great guy. Great leader in the space. He named eight things that we can learn in cybersecurity from the heist. And one of them was weak perimeter and blind spots. Two, outdated systems. And one, lack of readiness and tooling, which is what I think Sunil was also highlighting. People don't have the plans. Stuff is going to happen. The proverbial fan is going to hit the stuff sooner. The stuff is going to hit the proverbial fan. Sorry, my dyslexia takes the best of me. So, but you just have to have the plans, the readiness to recover. And I think even Sunil's point was you don't need to have a warm spot. You just have to have a plan to move to a different location in a amount of time.
Yeah. Yeah, as long as you know your limits, and you're not over-investing. I mean, over-investing is kind of more of a crime than any of this stuff sometimes. Yeah.
Or rather, you'll lose business as well. There's a guaranteed amount of money that you will lose if you over-invest in resiliency, right? It's a committed spend. And if you don't really have it's a calculation. It is ultimately a risk calculation.
It's actuarial science, right?
Yeah.
You mean like spending $10 million?
It's reverse insurance. It's like saying this premium is higher than the payout, what we need. Yeah.
$10 million of investment to save for an event that's, you know, might not happen in your lifetime.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, there's a perverse incentive for a lot of risk managers, aka lawyers, right? They're the ones that we meet the most, to, you know, just do the math for themselves. You know, like, is it worth spending $1 million to mitigate a 1% risk of a $2 million loss? Not for the company, but for the lawyer, it's just $1 million out. I'm not getting fired, and it saves a 1% chance of me getting fired. Let's go. So, I mean, as companies, you need to align the risk manager's incentives with the company's incentives. All right. So AWS and JLR, both in the headlines because they had some issues. AWS is not being cybersecurity related. F5, whoo. Man, that's been super hot for us, completely right down the middle of the fairway when it comes to cybersecurity. I'll do the quick layperson's recap. They disclosed that they had had a major nation state breach, including access to their source code for, I think it was 12 months for a prolonged period.
12 months.
And they let everybody know, hey, be aware this is going on. And then a lot of the major national agencies like NCSC, and I don't know if CISA did something on this or not. I feel awful that I don't even know. But basically advising people on, hey, pay attention here. Here's what you should do. So they definitely were on their heels as well. They didn't have an interruption per se because they're not a live provider as much as a seller of hardware and virtual load balancing solutions. What are the reactions you're hearing to this one?
Okay, so I have a couple things to unpack here. First is, I think this was one of the first disclosures that was held back.
Embargoed,
Yeah, embargoed. So, and I can completely understand why, but this is one of those, you know, there's a precedent here for what gets held back in terms of disclosures.
Because of national security, is that right?
Yes, right, exactly. So that's interesting in itself.
National security.
To that point, it was deemed a national security issue. Why? Because this is the second piece I think is really interesting and should be emphasized. In the 10K, it says, you know, it was an undisclosed country, but pretty much every other article I saw says, hey, China did this. Not Volt Typhoon, not Fancy Bear, whatever, but China. Okay. Now, there are a couple of things I would say I would want to do even further here. First is, I think we don't do ourselves any service. We don't benefit by using these silly names. I mean, we've gotten to the point where we use these names. So I think we should call a spade, right? We say, hey, it was China that hacked us, okay? But I would actually go one step further. It's not China that hacked us. It's the Chinese Communist Party, okay? In the same way that we don't necessarily, like, if, to give you, over here, I'm currently in Tel Aviv, and we oftentimes get painted, hey, you know, we're from America, and so therefore we support Trump, right? Like, no, I mean, you know, there are certainly people who do support Trump and others who don't, right? But just because I'm American doesn't make me a Trump supporter or a Biden supporter. Just because you're Israeli doesn't make you a Bibi supporter, okay? Well, if you're a Chinese person doesn't make you a supporter of the Chinese communist government. Just because you're an Iranian doesn't make you supportive of the Iranian government. I can certainly say if just because you're North Korean doesn't mean that you're supportive of the North Korean government, right? So the perspective of making it clearer as to who is actually at fault here, and to say not some undisclosed country, but the Chinese Communist Party, I think we should try to push more towards that labeling. Okay, that's my second point here. And the third thing I would also say is, so CISA did actually release a guidance on F5. They said, hey, make sure you know what F5 devices you have, what's exposed to the internet, all these other sort of things. And when I saw the statement around what's exposed to the internet, well, one of the first things I was thinking of is, dang, I hope people know that they should not have, like, management interfaces exposed to the internet.
Oh,
And that was the advisory.
Yeah. Oh. But I think we're we've learned this lesson quite well when it comes to ICS, SCADA, operational technology. Mm-hmm. We need to really think of these technologies as operational technology that needs to sit on its own separate network, own separate plane, control plane. And if it's not on a separate control plane that is not exposed to the internet, then it's like putting your SCADA systems right there on the internet for anyone to touch.
I couldn't agree more. And like, people always go to like fundamentals and they're right about that. But the fundamental is not about patching, right? It's about attack surface management. And management interfaces need to be on management networks. And, you know, just to put it in today's parlance, you need to VPN you need to run your ZPA, your Cloudflare Warp or whatever before you can hit that interface. And you can't bank on patching the damn thing. I mean, you know, the thing it's actually serving, the actual nodes that it's the virtual IPs or whatever it is, they have to be facing the internet. Okay, great. But the rest of that thing, you need to close it off. I was working with earlier today, actually, I was looking at two findings from an attack service management product, and one of them was rated high and it was about a subdomain takeover. And the other one was rated low and it was about an SSH interface being exposed publicly. And because it didn't have any known vulnerabilities or whatever. And I imported those and ran AI on them with my own rubric to say, what's the real score? And I was really pleased to see it flip them. And it's because our rubric says SSH exposed to the internet.
Do you ask the question 3-4 times though, Jerry? Do you ask the same question 3-4 times and do you get the same answer?
This is in our product. All right. So the temperature is set to zero and it's much less probabilistic. Yes. Because that's an issue. I have customers who are like, hey, that seemed really great, but I ran it again and it changed everything. That was a huge sticking point.
Yeah.
And we also have to jam the prompt down its throat every single time. That's like, right? But like SSHD being, and port 22 SSH interactive being exposed on the internet, I consider that a big deal. Fully patched. Just because you don't have the people to constantly monitor it and there will be another RCE for it. Right? And when it happens, then what? Like, it's another mouth to feed. So kill it. Put it beyond CPA. So on this F5 thing, the thing that triggered me right away was, you know, it said, I got it, and I was an F5 customer for many years, and we worked very closely with them on a lot of development and fronted a lot of live bespoke applications with it. They were awesome. I consider them a great company or public company and an agile company in general, I could just say from working with them. Hopefully that hasn't changed. But the thing that triggered me right away was the guidance said, F5 has had a bad guy in the network for 12 months, in particular, they had access to source code. So I'm immediately thinking like, oh, did they A, plant anything bad like SolarWinds, and B, now they know the source code and it gives you a leg up on discovering vulnerabilities. And then it said, make sure you go patch. And I thought, what a idiotic rubber stamp, same crap you say no matter what, you know, like, oh, your head hurts. Have you drank water? How about patching? Have you patched? Like, it's... So how do you patch to solve against what we just described? And then I questioned myself and I thought, well, let me see if they introduce some new patches. And sure enough, part of the embargo, well, arguably part of the embargo, the day they did finally release, they also had a patch batch. And then I noticed it was a quarterly release though, and they do it every quarter. So it's like, oh, maybe it's coincidence. So I used Comet, Perplexity Comet. First time I got anything useful out of it so far. And I said, go back through all the quarterly patch releases and count how many highs were mitigated in each quarter going back 3 or 4 years. And I shared that graph here. And that was really interesting, right? Because it's like triple, you double or triple this time. So someone was burning off a lot of backlog and patching a lot of stuff. And I hate to admit it, but patching might make some sense here because these are things that they knew were vulnerable while the bad guys were in there. And I have it on good word, the bad guys were accessing the risk register, the vulnerability list.
Wow.
As well. So they knew about these things before they were patched.
Let me ask you a question. When they released that big old spike that I see, what I'm assuming is that's a lot.
31 highs. Yeah. October 15th.
What's your gut sense, fellas, that potentially ended up breaking customers' environment? do you think it's, I'm just throwing it out there. Sometimes the reason I ask is oftentimes you have security people and QA and everybody saying, but yeah, we got to pass this thing. But somebody in QA or maybe in business that are concerned that it's going to impact some customer who, by the way, hasn't updated their F5 in a long time. And unfortunately, they pay gazillions of dollars a year. The government, not going to say anymore. But what do you think?
So this is God's work. This is an important part of cybersecurity, right? What you need to do is if you're an F5 shop, you get 31 patches in there. A, figure out which of the products you're actually running. That's kind of easy. You can't patch something if you don't even have it. Then B, you know, we've got these bunch of load balancers, and out of the 31 highs, let's say 16 of them relate to code that we actually have on our load balancers. The next step is, what the hell does that patch fix? The management interface. Oh, we don't have that on the internet. Cool. Let's QA that for 3 weeks before we put it in. Oh, it affects the vector here is hot and live. Someone could pop it tonight. Whoa, stop everything. Let's get on it. If you can do that dance, then you're in good shape. But no matter who you are, if you drop all 31 or all 17 tonight, it will break stuff that's live. Yeah.
Yeah.
And when you back it out, it'll stay backed out for the rest of the time. You'll never put it back on there. And you'll get popped in 18 months and everyone will roll their eyes about how you didn't patch. Yeah, I've definitely seen exploits where the patch was applied and then was rolled out, rolled back, and then things were exploited.
So. And my advice to everybody is, before you patch, reboot. Before you patch, reboot first and test all your connections. I told you, this happened to me before.
Just so you know they what to blame the problem on?
Well, that's absolutely, because then what happens is if you patch, they'll blame it on you and you reboot and you're like, oh, it's your patch. When in reality, it was some crap bug that you had there forever that hadn't manifested itself until you reboot. So moral of the story, reboot before you patch, have everybody test the reboot, then patch.
Well, I mean, it goes back to the general true positive, right? Before you rely on anything, make sure you have a true positive. Like if you look in logs for a problem, you don't see it. That absence doesn't mean anything unless you can recreate something and make sure it shows up. Like you want a true positive. And likewise, you and your reboot, you're like, okay, things actually are working first. Or more importantly, things aren't working. Before the patch, shit, we had a problem. We didn't realize it. Okay. And before we move off of this, so we talked about three companies here. And sometimes we talk about market, cyber market, stock prices, the normal disclaimers that we don't have any reason, any validity in giving you financial advice. So that's not what this is meant to be. So AWS stock, I remember looking in the middle of the headlines and the markets figured it out that it didn't flinch. I think it was up 1 or 2% in the middle of all this. Nobody thought for us. Everybody was looking for a buying opportunity and waiting for it to go down. And every time it flinched, they bought and the whole thing went up. All right, so some people have figured this out. Tata Motors, the owner of JLR, I didn't even realize. So they're listed in India. I don't know if there's an ADR or some way to trade it as for one of us, but who cares? Man, took a massive hit. All right, down 35, 40%. An F5 had like a 10% hit. It's the classic, oh man, someone got breached. That to me was the CrowdStrike buying opportunity. I bought some. I not only bought some, but I put in more orders expecting it to go down further. And it only went down 10% though. So I think people are starting to pick up on this pattern and things aren't getting trounced.
Jerry, but you're living the vida loca.
I'm up like a buck, so I couldn't monetize it like we used to. I think that the markets, they've been listening to the podcast, they figured it out. So then someone might ask me, what about Tata? Jerry, aren't you going to run in there? I don't know. I don't think so. I think that is the exception. That is the, like in all these cases, CrowdStrike, everything included, by the time that the stock is down and you should I buy or not, the problem's already fixed. So my argument's always been like, it's over now. It's just a matter of PR and optics. But man, that JLR thing, it just took, the impact is real, right? I mean, it would affect my long-term, you know, belief in that company and their ability to respond to all kinds of things.
Well, yes and no. So first of all, it's funny that you ran Comet, Perplexity's Comet. I tend to think of it like AI as an intern. You're letting an intern loose and the intern drops a database or something. I remember there was a Reddit article where some intern said, hey, I dropped this database on their first day and the CTO is really mad and all these things. And it wasn't really the intern's fault. There's also a story about how people made all these different mistakes and they thought they were going to get fired. And the CEO or the CTO or whatever said, look, we just spent $250,000 on you making a mistake. That was a $250,000 lesson, okay? I'm not going to let you go because that's a $250,000 investment I just made in you to not make that mistake ever again. Okay. So what is happening here now as an investor in this company, the company has invested $25 billion, I think. I forget what the exact, $2.5 billion? The decimal might be wrong, but they just invested $2.5 billion or something like that in being a more resilient organization. Okay. Yeah. And if they can actually survive, then they're actually going to be a really sound organization to count on.
It reminds me of a conversation I had with a friend of mine, a former colleague, a couple of weeks ago, and he had experience in security. Let's call it what it is, security breach. He, the way he comported himself through it all was pretty right on. I'm not going to name names, and I'm not going to name the company, but I thought he and the company communicated well with his customers, identified the issue and addressed it. And I said to him, congratulations, I think you won the lottery. And he's like, why? Well, you're a hot commodity because you went through this. You experienced one of these things and you came out looking reasonably well with your customers. You were upfront, you communicated on a timely basis and you didn't listen to your lawyers all the time. don't take that.
No, I'm with you. Yeah. Again, it's in their selfish interest to tell you to shut up and not talk to anybody, right?
Correct.
They can get fired over that.
Correct.
The same
so
thing.
So to Sunil's things, I also think, depending on how you handle it, your career can actually shine because you've actually learned in the school of hard knocks.
Yeah. The thing that sucks, though, is like on the JLR one, I mean, they got Mandiant and God knows probably everybody under the sun to dig in and understand how their systems worked. And then give them some reasonable assurance that they had evicted the intruder. And then they fired up the assembly lines again. They did the black start, nothing worked, and then got, and they spent 30, 40 plus days and got the spray boots working again. They had resiliency and from now on they can respond to the next one of these, or is it just there's probably not going to be another one that's good enough? I don't, it's hard to tell.
I wasn't even suggesting that that the biggest benefit is that they'll be able to handle another ransomware attack. I mean, if they have another ransomware attack, then something really got screwed up in starting this all over again. But rather, they'll have much more efficient operational processes. I think so. In many ways, they have an opportunity to say, okay, if we could do this better, differently. Redesign some of these things. I know they're just trying to get things back up and running, but they also have an opportunity to say, look, we don't have to do it the old way. We can do it a different way. And this different way, if it's not the right way, they have now an ability to adapt or change that way because they're rebuilding effectively right now.
Yeah.
And so it gives them a lot more agility, not just for cybersecurity things, but just as a company. It should give them more agility as a company. That is what I would say gives them, if they survive, and that's a big if they survive as a company, then I think that as a company, we should see them growing much faster and being much more competitive just because they've rebooted the company.
Yeah.
Almost literally, right?
Yeah, and I mean, I feel very confident they will survive. And one thing that's really interesting is that the black eye here has no correlation to the market appeal. You know, if it was JLR employees, child labor, I think the people who buy Jaguars and Land Rovers, and not that anything special about those cars, but people in the general public has
sympathy to that, and they're not interested in, you know, in supporting that, and it would affect sales. I can't imagine anyone worrying about their car because they suffered from a cyber problem whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And so I think like the brand appeal is 100% there. I bet we'll be reading about this in Harvard Business Review in 10 years and about how synthetic scarcity was a great, amazing side benefit of this. Like, remember during the pandemic, that ship with all the Porsches sank and the prices went through the roof? All the 911s were in the sea. And in the secondary market, the prices of 911s went through the roof, you know, net. It did a lot. I mean, that was the secondary market. But then when the primary came back on, they were able to charge way over MSRP. And to this day, that's certainly true. Huh. So who knows? Maybe there's a silver lining is for them. People still want Jaguars and Land Rovers, and now they can't get them for a while. And maybe when that supply is unpacked, they're going to have a bang, an awesome quarter. I shouldn't have shared that.
Well, I just did a research on used car prices for Range Rovers and where the market is in 2025. Now, granted, I haven't done a really good analysis, and granted, there's tariffs and there's everything else in the world. But the prices looks like it's going up. So,
yeah, we'll see.
Yeah.
All right. Next topic. This one came across my desk. Through whoever in LinkedIn, I got connected to this article from Sam Lyles. I didn't know him before that. And I see he runs a whole blog, and he definitely has some contrarian and adversarial points of view about something. But he's also I found it a very compelling authorship, the way he wrote in this thing. But what he was talking about was basically, I call it risk management versus security engineering. Mm. He calls it the CISO dilemma, risk management versus security engineering. And he's basically lampooning the caricature of the CISO who walks in and says, and I'll quote, "We're carrying $300 million in exposure, flashing his spreadsheet like a cheap badge, but $1 million investment can buy down $50 million of security debt." See? And then he goes on to really assail that and say that that's just BS and that's not real when people say that, which I totally agree with. And I think that it's an indictment on CRQ, cyber risk quantification. And I've seen companies try to not only do that, like the macro level, well, buying down risk, but even doing it down to the risk register entry level and having, and some of the risk register tools try to have FAIR incorporated into it and to assign an annual loss expectancy, right? So in other words, you'd say we have management interfaces on our F5s or pointed to the internet. I'd agree. I'd call the likelihood of that getting popped a probable, and I would call, and I'm doing this purposely, qualitative, subjective words, and I would call the impact to be either severe or high, depending on what's behind them and what network they're in. But this camp, the lampooned CEO, CISO, would say, oh, that is a $26,000, $595.33 issue. So therefore, it's worth it for us to patch. And I think that's bull hockey, as Mario would say.
Okay, first of all, all right. Okay, so full disclosure for folks who don't know, I'm a advocate for. I used to be on the FAIR board, and I brought those practices into Bank of America, and so I'm a strong champion of cyber risk quantification. However, there's a misconception around that the quantification has to be in dollars. Okay. So I think quantification doesn't necessarily, I don't think the unit has to necessarily be in dollars. Dollars make sense for Jack Jones and Nationwide Insurance, when he was at an insurance provider. Mm-hmm. But if your job is the military, let's say, if you're in the military, then the unit to measure is not dollars. It's going to be soldiers' lives or something like that, right?
I think that's even worse.
Well, hold on. But the point is that you're quantifying the unit of quantification is whatever appeals most to whatever creates a visceral people can viscerally relate to. Okay, so that's just point number one. Point number two is that this process earlier you mentioned words like it's probable and it's. I forget the other.
High. He said high, Sunil.
High.
High okay. Or low. Ooh,
the impact is high.
It makes me itch. It's awful.
And the likelihood it was probable. Okay, well, I mean, the basic practice when you with cyber risk quantification is to not, is to say, look, can you actually put a like an approximation on that, like a number,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
Probable.
No.
Like, what do you think means probable, right? Is that 10%? Is that 20%? Whatever. And I've actually found this to be a really, ever since COVID and everyone got on Zoom. Mm-hmm. One of the nice things about Zoom and these other conferencing platforms is you can ask everyone to pull up a chat window and say, "Wait, hold on, wait. Let's all kind of figure out what we all think probable means." Okay, so put in the number. Don't hit enter, but just put in the number into chat. And on the count of three, we all press enter,
That's cool. We see
separately, so you don't have any like. Knowing, exactly. influencing, anchoring. You don't have any anchoring.
Hold on. Sunil, don't forget your train of thought, but I'm going to interrupt for a second. And then what you find out when you do that is who's a coward, because 33% of people don't hit enter. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't realize what we were doing. Fired immediately. Out the door. You know what the hell is going on.
Did it not happen,
Sunil? Every single time that people
didn't
hit
enter. I tell people, look, here's exactly what we're going to do. I will expect everyone to press enter. Type in the number. Don't press enter yet. Does everyone have a number ready to go? Yes or no? You don't? Okay, we'll put in a number. Ready? 1, 2, 3. And then you see everyone mm-hmm. put in the number, right? It shows up.
The cowards. But yeah.
Yeah.
No, not even the cowards. And if there is a coward, then it's pretty obvious, right? But the point is that at the end of the day, you end up with this spread. And the spread is exactly the same process that we go through when we do cyber risk quantification. Does anyone actually know the right answer? No, nobody knows. But you know, it's the wisdom of the crowds that taking advantage of here. But even better than that is that you now have documented assumptions.
Yeah.
You've documented your assumptions. And if downstream your number's wrong, we just go back and adjust our priors. We said, hey, this is what we thought the range was. Clearly, we were wrong. Because, you know, new evidence has come in to suggest something else. Okay, let's now update our powers and say, what do we think the probability is now, right?
Yeah.
Anyway, if you look at the whole practice of forecasting, super forecasters, Philip Tetlock, you know, blah, 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 the best forecasters are the ones that go back and revisit their assumptions and
Correct.
Revisit their priors.
So I am of the Sunil school. I did embrace FAIR. When I was at Snowflake, this was a big thing for us. So unlike our friend Jerry here, who's the school of the traffic light, you know, red, yellow, and green. You know, I do believe you need to do some level of quantifying for a very basic thing of everything Sunil's saying. So, but let me tell you what the problem was that we experienced. So I cannot repeat what Sunil said. I completely agree with what he's saying. I went through that ourselves. The problem is once you start, it's interesting to say, well, if this impact, this event occurs, how long is it going to take us to recover? And you can say, well, this is how many people are going to work on it. This is how many people are going to be impacted during that outage. Here's what we could potentially do. Yo, by the way, we're only in US East 1, but it's going to take us 2-3 weeks to recover. Why don't we do US West, and we only pay, you know, $1,000, $2,000 for having that call site for us. That's a way of using that. I think where we struggled, I'm just going to say where we struggled was once you get outside of how many people are impacted, resources, how long does it take you to come up again, you get into this liability lawsuits potentials. And that's where you get outside of the what is possibility, what is this big impact could result like from losing customers, for example, losing sales, getting, you know, legal lawsuits and all that stuff. And that's where we kind of got a little bit kind of wishy-washy.
Help, because this is a very common question I get with people I talk to about FAIR and just risk quantification in general. I mentioned earlier, what's the unit of the measure that's most viscerally that someone can they actually have an answer for because they know very directly it affects them very directly. Okay, and because of that, it's also very visceral to them as well. So a unit of measure can be just downtime. I don't need them to tell me what the cost is of that downtime. I would just say, hey, if I know it's usually not DNS, but if it happened to be DNS. how much downtime might you suffer? Okay. And all I need is just like their estimation of like their downtime. How that downtime translates into, you know, millions of dollars, that they don't have any idea what that is. But we would, but they would have an idea of, yeah, if we had to rebuild this, our downtime would be 6 hours. Okay, great. That's wonderful. Okay, as a part of the overall analysis, we say, gee whiz, you know what? If this went down, we it's not just DynamoDB that would go down. It's like all of US East 1. But that person that you're talking to wouldn't know the bigger impact. They just know viscerally how they would experience 6 hours of downtime in this one particular service. If you're talking to somebody in sales, then their unit of measure is customers, right? How many customers would you lose? At the end of the day, you can translate them all to dollars, okay? But when you're talking to a certain stakeholder and trying to get their buy-in around, hey, should we consider this sort of preventative measure or this whatever measure that we're looking at? If you can put it into units of measure that they experience every day, which for the vast majority of people is not dollars, then they'll have a much clearer understanding of what the value and the benefit is of the type of thing.
But I think that's where the problem is at, though, Sunil. The minute you get into this whole thing about, you go ask a salesperson, how many customers are you going to lose because of this? And honestly, how many sales reps would even want? No, and you're talking about the wisdom of the crowd potentially. But as you go more into that fluff, you get more fluffy. And that's where I think quantitative analysis kind of tends to fall apart.
Well, yeah, wisdom of the crowds here, I would say wisdom of informed crowds that I
I mean, what a salesperson, Sunil, come on. You're asking a salesperson for their customers, though, man.
Yeah, but a salesperson would have zero idea about downtime, you know, what the impact of a 6-hour DNS outage is, right? But they would have a clear understanding of, hey, what customers would you have affected? True. And so anyway, it's you use their unit of measure that resonates most with them.
True.
Yeah, I mean, I think I agree a lot on the fundamentals here, but then like the way that they're manifesting, I totally disagree with. Like if you broke a given company into 10 departments, and by the way, you have to do that, right? You all know, so you go to any Fortune 500 company, most of them, they don't even know how they organize their departments, right? There's some database that has 655 business units, one that has three. Like that taxonomy is an issue in itself. But if you organize them all into 10 departments, and then you basically said, give me the value. If your department were unavailable, what would the cost be to the business? And then you added those 10 together, it would be like 40 times the market capitalization of the company. The one missing element in this is that there needs to be a penalty for overestimating. So as people say, like, I think that's a big deal, there needs to be live, well, okay, so then we're going to implement, and you got to start talking about the pain, like the balance, the cost of doing this. And if that's there, then people will come back to earth. But when people are just in the room trying to show how much they care about risk, they all pump it up to the max. They say everything
is the world. This is why I think documenting the assumptions are particularly helpful here, because when we went through this exercise for, let's say, DLP inside of a major bank, we ended up with the total number that we ended up with was something like 10 times the annual revenue of the organization.
Exactly,
right?
Like, what I'm talking about.
Yeah, like something. So I mean, the point is ultimately we're saying one or more of our assumptions are clearly incorrect. Okay. But we now have those documented. Let's go and revisit them and readjust, because everyone
That's
agrees.
I know it's 100% cost to actually just get those people in a meeting, all that. And I mean, yeah. I know how it is. Like, I love the idea of saying, like, what's the impact here? And the reason I like my TLP, if you will, my traffic light protocol, and it's not, I use 5, not 3, okay, is that, I mean, you can roughly think of severe as the market cap of a company, and as one level down as that divided by 10. You can use orders of magnitude for people who must.
Okay. So again, I generally agree with you on the extremes, right?
Mm-hmm.
But anyone who has ever had a risk register, gone through a large risk register, you recognize there's a ton of stuff. If you have a 5-point scale, there's a ton of stuff that's 3. Okay. 3, 3, 3.
That's true.
And so, you got to figure out which of those will make the cut and which ones don't. You got the high consequence, high probability and maybe even medium probability events covered. But it's all the other stuff that people need to find a better way to organize.
So I'm gonna recognize Jerry's point. I think it's really important. So even a broken clock is right twice a day. So I'm gonna see. Oftentimes when you go do this business impact analysis, you have some external auditor coming in, and the type of way they ask these questions lead into, yes, your department needs to be up and running all the time and yada, yada, yada. Yep. So that's true. It's the right questions to say, well, in order to do that, Mr. Department A, we're going to have to take you offline for about 2-3 weeks to upgrade the systems, yeah, to make it more resilient. So because it is, you're high, we got to do this. And then
to reserve seats for you, legal department, in the business continuity site, because you say you're so essential, that's cool. But we're going to have to take seats away from operations and customer support.
We're going to hit your budget.
Well, it has to be zero sum. And because then a lot of people be like, well, we're not that important. Yeah, answer the phones first. Yeah. Okay. Well, that's what we were talking about. You can't do it in silos where everything is super. Gold. But when you are talking about an atomic risk, I mean, let's get back to it. RF5 devices have management interfaces exposed to the internet. That is a risk register entry in my world. I know that most people like nebulous, platitudes that'll never get closed, but I like ones that are real. What's that worth? Assigning a dollar value to that is asinine.
Okay, so hold on. Yeah, so let's go back to the original point in the article that you were pointing out. Risk management versus security engineering. And it being a dilemma. I actually don't see it as a dilemma. I see it as, if it is a dilemma, or one perceives it as a dilemma, you're actually mischaracterizing the nature of the challenge that you're dealing with. There's a model called the Cynefin model, Cynefin model, and it characterizes four states from chaotic to complex to complicated to clear. And it's this 2x2 grid where on the left side, you have chaotic and complex. On the right side, you have complicated and clear. Okay, so just imagine this, grid now. But think of everything on the left, complex and chaotic. Those are things that you cannot change. You're in a predicament. And when you're in a predicament, the best you can do is manage your risks. That's risk management. On the right side, when things are complicated and clear, those are problems you can actually solve. Okay, putting F5 management IPs
on the internet
off of the internet into a management network, that is not a predicament. That's a problem you can solve, and that is a security engineering function that you should just go do.
Yeah.
Okay, and I think part of the argument in the article is to say, look, if you think you have this dilemma, if you even have the opportunity to do security engineering, just do it. There's no risk management you need to do because you can actually solve. You can engineer the problem out of there, right?
You just did a 4-box qualitative risk assessment. I gave you 5 boxes, and you said it wasn't quantitative enough for you. I mean, come on. This is fun. I think we're going to be back on this topic at
some
point.
I give you kudos. Don't put me in the same place with this guy.
No, I like this. Before we run out of time too much, I'd like to bump ahead to the I love this topic, the move the needle. I just think this can go on forever, but we have a list of products and categories and all that, and I think people are really interested in that.
Been on my list for a while, and I want to recognize a pioneer in the industry who really did move the needle for the industry as a whole. And given that this is a topic that I don't think anyone's going to disagree with this one, but yes, it was DNS. And
DNS moved the needle.
One of the biggest contributors to, I guess, both being making a problem, but also really coming up with good solutions for that, is Paul Vixey, and he created this company called Farsight Security. And if you've ever consumed anything around newly observed domains, if you've ever consumed, there's so much stuff that Paul's team came up with at Farsight Security that I think moved the needle in terms of DNS, using DNS as a threat intelligence feed and being able to do malware detection and all these amazing things with just DNS alone is what Farsight Security did. But that said, the founder of Farsight Security, Paul Vixie, him alone, I think, moved the needle. I think, just for those who don't know what his contributions, I would guess, even with today's AI systems, and maybe even more so with today's AI systems, he is probably, the code that he's written contributes to, I would say, minimally 50, 60, maybe 70% of all automation that's happening anywhere in the world. Right. Because if you do a man page, if you look up the documentation on cron, you'll see who wrote it.
I love it. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Oh, and really? How about Bind?
Oh,
yeah. I mean, you might say he's the author of DNS. And like some people would kind of lampoon, oh, it's DNS fault or whatever. I mean, that moves the needle. Like, you know, Bind and how crappy DNS could have been and all the extensions that are available. You could do DNS well, thanks to Paul. You could do it poorly too, but at least he gave you the choice. Yeah. I'd agree with that. I mean, I don't think for Farsight moved the needle. Bind moved the needle. Paul moved the needle without a doubt. And that's not crapping on Farsight at all. I'm just like, I have a high bar for change the outcome on security and made things different. I wouldn't abandon it. I wouldn't reverse anybody who invested in feeds without a doubt. I'm a passive DNS lover and I use it personally, but nobody else does. I mean, you know, the people on mailing lists with us, those 16 nerds use it, but how it's integrated in the products. I mean, I can see places all the time where it would be good and it's just not there.
So I guess I agree. I'm going to now move the needle from my version and just goes to show you that, you know, while Sunil's flying a fire jet with his concepts of move the needle, I'm still just riding a tricycle. All right. I'm not even doing a bicycle. This is how simple I am. Okay, folks, really simple. So please forgive me and please drop your whatever you're drinking because you're going to spit it out right now. So I think Vanta and Drada, I want to give kudos to them. I think they have moved the needle. And I think they meant why? How so? You know, if even 5, 6 years ago, 7 years ago, when you were trying to, let's just say, a simple SOC 2 type 2, collecting the evidence, manually collecting, making sense of it, trying to look at logs, imagining every auditor going, can you run this script? I need to collect all the information, all the services running, all the file systems on your server and bring it back and share it with me. That was the old way that we used to do until Vanta and Drada, like who are able to automate a lot of this stuff, got rid of a lot of the manual stuff that our companies do. The employees,
that's right,
my employees, our employees waste on and could take months to get this information done. With Vanta and Drada, they speed that whole thing. And there has, you know, downwards consequences as well, downstream consequences, because now even the auditors who certify you or authorize you for a SOC 2 type 2, their prices are actually dropping as well because they're able to collect information much quicker. And I'm not talking about, you know, what normally would take 50 to 70,000 for SOC 2 type 2. Yes, 6, 7 years ago, that's what the price was. And that's not a PwC.
Oh, we used to spend $70,000 to $80,000 a SOC 2. And they would take,
well, I talked to an auditor.
Go ahead, Sunil, but leave some, don't leave this topic because I got a lot to unload on this one.
No. If I'm trying to buy tickets to security theater, it's like a race to the bottom. And,
you know, we got 6 showings of BitTight.
And I'll at least give kudos to Vanta and Drada for helping us drive those ticket prices down. But let's just also just recognize that it is security theater. A lot of 100%. This, even the evidence collection, is security theater.
I totally agree. And I would say, right, they didn't move the needle at all. They saved us all money to play theater, and that's really nice. I said $80,000 to SOC 2. And my poor Drada and Vanta, because in the GRC space, the only tools that are out there are C. It's just compliance. That's the only thing that's had any success in the space. And correct. So these are compliance platforms. They are cranking out about $300 million a year each in revenue and have some massive valuations, which is awesome. But if you're an investor in these companies, you're looking at the CAGR and you're expecting it to keep on going. And it's going to keep on going. And it's not, because not only have they saturated the market, But the prices now, there's this massive tail of starts. Senseba is one, Scrut, $6,000 sock twos. They do not like that. And so Vanta, Andrada, and the other big players are like, okay, enough with the C. Now we need to monetize the R and the G, right? The governance and the risk. And they're not having a lot of success there. Just like Archer, it's spinning in circles. So I think there's a lot of potential there. That's my space, right? In full disclosure, and why my company exists is to do proper risk management. But all that to say, the way that they moved it is kind of an amazing shell game, because the way they were able to drop the price precipitously, and given it's all theater, there's really no harm in this. But it used to be, to get a SOC 2, you had PwC or the cheap auditor or whatever, but sitting in your office for weeks. And they were asking for screenshots. They were surfing, shoulder surfing. They were having interviews and meeting with people and onward. And now the layperson, and that's not very lay, but person who's dealing with these companies at a very high level would say, cool, they've automated that. It's not true, because what they automate was hooking up. What they automate now is hooking into GCP and AWS and finding the patch status of all of your containers, or the recertification levels on the users that are in that SaaS tool and all of that. And when you wind back the clock to what they were doing in the office, it wasn't even those things. They were asking about totally different things. And totally. Somehow Vanta and Drata were able to say, we can't automate the stuff that PwC is looking at, but we can automate this other thing. Let's just convince the world that those things are part of the control criteria, the common criteria set. And everyone was like, sure, it's all theater anyway. Let's pretend that a SOC 2, that security is shown by your settings in these SaaS tools instead of your procedural guides and your response playbooks and all the crap they used to. We completely shifted what we look at to make automation possible and lower the cost. And it was easy because it was just all BS to begin with anyway.
That's exactly. So Sunil, you're correct. This is all Kabuki theater, but it was Kabuki theater at a premium price.
That's right.
Now we can really see what real value these things, and quite, I'm not going to say worthless. I'm not going to go at the level you're going, close. Sunil, but close enough. But now the price kind of aligns with that. And I think it's going to keep driving the prices even lower.
Yeah. Yeah, it used to cost you $80,000 for a load of crap, and now it costs you $6,000 for a load of crap. That is a net positive. That is a win.
And well, you can do it in two months, maybe. 2 months, okay, maybe less.
Let me be clear. It's a real win if before it was $80,000, now it's $6,000, and the company spends $74,000 on more security.
Oh, yeah, sure. That'd be nice. Yeah,
but
I agree.
More than likely, my guess is, with the $80,000 they spent, a new startup or some company will have spent, zero on security, still get their SOC 2 as a result.
That's a really good point. Somehow. That's actually a really good point. That's a good point.
And now they can spend $6,000 on a SOC 2 and still spend zero, right? If they actually truly spend money on security because it's cheaper to get the SOC 2, that's a real win.
I'm in a startup. That's not in security, Sunil. You guys are in security, but I'm not in security, but security is important. I'm going to use that money to invest in security tooling early on so I can build as secure as I can when the field's still green, and I'm going to make it a selling point. I'm going to try to differentiate myself from the competition. Hmm. That's what smart startups
could
do. I'm not saying
that's
smart.
Good news. All right, we got time for one more on. Well, I Archer was on there, and I would say that when I talk about GRC, I briefly mentioned them, but kudos to Archer for trying to do governance and risk 20 years ago. But on the downside, I've never seen a program benefit from the millions of dollars that they invested in that. And when I say million, it's because you could probably still see it. And their revenue to this date is insane. They are still cranking out a lot. And I asked a lot of CISOs recently, hey, I want to talk to some of you that are Archer customers. I want to know why you're an Archer customer, what you love. No one would even admit it. we're talking just shy of $1 billion in ARR going into Archer. So they're out there, and our friends are just shoveling money to say that they have Archerness.
So I think I agree if you're generally speaking that that people bought Archer for the true GR and C. And as we all, as we talked about before, most of us use these GRC tools only for the C part. You could argue that Archer, at least that what we try to do with Archer is really put more attention to the G and R part. But even then, I feel like it was it wasn't a discipline that was so well defined that it could be embodied easily in technology.
Totally agree.
Interesting. Interesting.
Yeah, I mean, everybody does exactly. Risk management completely differently. Most of them don't do it effectively.
To Mario's point earlier, the reason why Drada and Vanta was able to drive the C part of that equation down to $6,000, whatever, is because a lot of that can be embodied in the technology. But the G and the R parts, I don't know how much of that can actually be embodied in the technology.
I think it can, but...
I would say the compliance reason why we're so focused on the C is a lot of it is the customers, our clients. They are demanding that. I don't want to say they're not sophisticated enough, but that's what they focus is on the compliance side of things instead of focusing on the other things.
Yeah, that's right. It's easy to get budget. When you're trying to close business, it's easy to get budget.
There you go. That's it.
Yeah. All right. Well, guys, this was fun. I'm glad we got to talk about the mood needle a little bit. And just for listeners out there, I'll say we've only made it probably about 40% of the way through this long list. So stay tuned for Okta's coming up. We're talking about the Fortinet checkpoint, Palo Alto world, and Darktrace and Vectra. And there's so many good ones out there. So I want to keep doing this. I think this is cool. But otherwise, guys, look, we've... there's no shortage of headlines here. I'm looking forward to updating on stuff that we did just talk about and adding anything else. And I'll just say for like people that are listening out there, we all have gotten some great, all three of us have gotten some great anecdotal face-to-face, chat-to-chat feedback and ideas, and it influences us on what we talk about. So definitely let us know either directly or use the LinkedIn for the adversarial podcast and comment on it right there. And we'll take that to heart on things that you'd like to hear more about, or if there's a part where you vomited in your mouth when Jerry said X or whatever, let's hear about it. All right. Well, thank you guys. As always, have a great weekend, and I'm looking forward to the next one.